You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, happy Genocide Day. Yes, we are broadcasting live today on Columbus Day. Some interesting stories about Christopher Columbus. There's a great debate going on in the House of Representatives. What legislation shall we look at? The Republicans are trying to figure out. We will get to Columbus in just a moment. The Republicans are trying to figure out what to do. They run the House of Representatives and have for the last year or thereabouts. And so far, they haven't brought any jobs legislation to the floor. So it's like, you know, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? I don't think that they know. But they're, where'd it go? I am looking for my, here it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. Maybe it's not. Here we go. This is just incredible. Okay, first of all, they're planning on voting. Keep in mind, we have 46 million people in poverty, 50 million people are uninsured, 16% real unemployment in the United States. And what are the House Republicans going to do this week under John Boehner and Eric Cantor? First of all, they're going to vote on 3 free trade agreements. Now, you know, let it be noted, this is bipartisan. The Democratic president, President Obama, wants these. I don't know why, but he wants them. The Republicans are going to vote on these. They may say no just to stick it in his eye. You know, they're very much into putting a thumb in his eye whenever they have a chance. But, free trade agreements are the things the big transnational corporations that make large campaign contributions, even corporations that don't do most of their business in the United States, kind of like. So they're going to vote on that. They're going to vote on legislation to gut the EPA. So all those jobs developing new technologies to clean the air, all those jobs developing new technologies to scrub the emissions of coal-fired power plants or oil plants, all those jobs that continue to be developed to make sure that our food is safer, our air is cleaner, our water is pure, all those jobs that will be gone, along with the EPA employees who would create the enforcement and the mechanism. They would create the need for those kind of jobs to protect us from greedy polluters and the corporations that love them. So they're going to vote on that, gutting the EPA. There's going to be a vote on banning abortions. This is a hand toss to the Value Voters Summit. And I want to share some thoughts with you about that. Oh, and they need to rename some post offices. They are going to rename some post offices this week. Probably after Ronald Reagan. Jobs bills on the Republican agenda for this week or any week? Zero. So the Value Voters Summit over the weekend. This was a tragic and bizarre circus. At the same time that Americans are, the 99% of us, and some more than others, but the 99% of us are in the ditch to varying degrees, and the 1% are making, literally hundreds to thousands of percent better off than they were when Reagan came into office. Top 1% doing fine. Champagne and caviar, selling great. Bottom 99%, screwed. So over the weekend, some of the 99%ers here in Washington, D.C. got the, and who knows where the idea came from, got the idea to go over to the Air and Space Museum and protest the drones because, we're killing people from the skies. And, it's kind of a Bushian, not kind of, it is a Bushian neocon foreign policy that we're following right now, this administration is following. And so they thought, you know, let's protest this. What they didn't realize was that there was a right-wing editor with one of the right-wing newspapers embedded with them, a guy who writes for the American Spectator. And he was one of the ones, he kind of led the charge at the cops when they got to the Air and Space Museum, which led the cops to pepper spray people. And then he ran around inside the museum and just had a cool old time and wrote all about it. He was so excited. And I've been telling you, there's a lot of us who remember it well. You know, the police provocateurs, the Asian provocateurs, the people who were embedded inside SDS, whose goal was to make it more violent so that there would be an excuse to crack down. Whether this guy is, whether he just did it on his own, I think it's going to come back and bite him in the butt. Or whether the editorial board at the American Spectator decided to send him is something we don't know yet. Or at least I don't know. I haven't seen anything about it. But the Occupy Wall Street and the 99%, pick your name, OWC, 99%, whatever. Those movements are spreading across the United States and across the world. And there are, of course, all kinds of groups who want to say, hey, this is our group, which is fine. I mean, this is the way these things happen. But the movement itself is purely organic. It is the rage of young people who are saddled with college debt and can't get a job, of middle-aged people who are seeing their wages stagnant and they can't achieve the American dream that their parents or grandparents had, of baby boomers who are looking at, their retirement stolen from them by the banksters on Wall Street in the Bush crash. I mean, this is a multi-generational stand-up and outrage. I thought one of the things that was really interesting, Chris Hedges was writing about, he went down to the Occupy Wall Street group, Liberty Square in, or Plaza or Park or whatever in New York City, and tells the story of Ketchup and a few other people. And basically talks about how, it's this diffuse movement. But it is the moment. This is the moment. So in the midst of this, you get right wingers, trying to sabotage it. And then there's other right wingers making fun of it. It was very interesting. Over the weekend, I got forwarded an email with a video. John Lewis showed up. I think it was at Occupy Atlanta. And the group had a 10-minute discussion. I mean, he was on his way to an event, and he said, let's stop by, and if they want to hear from me, cool, and if not, then that's fine. And, John Lewis, a giant of the civil rights movement, a contemporary of Martin Luther King's. And they had a 10-minute discussion about whether they should break their agenda, the process that they were in the middle of, to allow John Lewis to speak, and they ultimately decided not to, but to invite him, but to honor him, to tell him that they respected him and they would love to hear from him, but a little later on. And, of course, later on he had things to go to and things to do. So they basically sent him away. And he said, that's fine with me. That's democracy. He said he was actually, he thought it was great that what they were doing. But the right-wingers are like, what? These guys don't want somebody to speak to them? And I'm like, what, you think that what democracy looks like is that, Dick Armey sends in a bus, a $200,000 bus with a $100,000 paint job, and you have a jumbotron and a stage, and you bring in stars?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm telling you, the politicians on the right and the Tea Party senior fellows are totally confused by this. Totally confused. Back to Edison Day. This portion of the Tom Hartman program is underwritten in part by Stamps.com, Carbonite.com, and EdisonFactor.com. Well, you can tell it's a Monday. Welcome back. I'm looking at my glass of Edison Factor thinking I'm going to, and I say, coming right back with Edison Day. No, it's Columbus Day. And before I get to that, how much changes in 6 minutes? 6 minutes ago, I said, I don't know who's behind these movements to infiltrate and trash the 99% movement or the Occupy Wall Street movement, but Li Fong does. Li Fong has been on this program many times. He's one of the best investigative journalists in America, and he writes for the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org. And this was posted just about an hour and a half ago, but I just discovered it. Journalists funded by vulture capitalist Paul Singer, campaign to smear Wall Street protests by Li Fong, actually is how it's pronounced. Spelled F-A-N-G. And that's his title. And he talks about how this guy named Paul Singer, who is a Republican activist, a hedge fund manager who worth over $900 million. The guy's almost a billionaire, although he runs a $17 billion hedge fund. Li Fong writes, Singer, manager of a $17 billion hedge fund, earned the moniker Vulture Capitalist for buying the debt of third world countries for pennies on the dollar, then using his political and legal connections to extract massive judgments to force collection, even from nations suffering from starvation and violent conflicts. They've done this in Panama, Ecuador, Poland, the Ivory Coast, Turkmenistan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. In addition to squeezing impoverished countries, Li Fong writes, with sovereign debt schemes, Singer speculates in the oil markets. You know, it obviously jacks up gas prices here. Apparently, Greg Palast has exposed him in various pieces. He was a top donor to the Swift Boat Veterans. So anyhow, guess who works for an organization that is funded in part by Paul Singer? That would be Patrick Howley, who is the reporter for the American Spectator, which is funded in part by Paul Singer, who was one of the guys, you know, provoking the cops, running the police barricade into the Air and Space Museum on Saturday here in Washington, D.C., that caused the cops to shut down the place and pepper spray people who were trying to get in. Another guy who's trashing the 99% movement is a guy by the name of Josh Barrow. He's a journalist who writes for the National Review, the New York Daily News. He draws a salary from the Wriston Fellowship at the Manhattan Institute. This is, according to Li Fong, a big business advocacy think tank in New York. Paul Singer, is the chairman of the Manhattan Institute and oversees the Wriston annual fundraiser. So it looks like, and by the way, this is the guy who hosted Justice Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito to speak at his $25,000 plate dinners. So he's buying Supreme Court justices. He's got a $17 billion hedge fund, and his people are trying to infiltrate or screw up or lead into violent confrontation with the police the Occupy Wall Street movement and the 99 and or the, you know, the 99% movement. It really is quite remarkable when you think about it. Meanwhile, as a consequence of the banksters, of the Wall Street guys, of the guys running the billion-dollar hedge funds and doing the high-frequency trading and not loaning a penny to small business, I think 17% of the total loan portfolio of the big banks in America is with small businesses. So it's not a penny, but it's very, very little. And they're not, I mean, President Obama passed that legislation back early in his administration that gave banks actually an incentive to refinance people's mortgages at lower interest rates and even to write down some of the principal. And the banks just aren't bothering to do it. They've figured out other more profitable ways to deal with people, like evicting them from their homes. So every day, 3,000 people, today, 3,000 people are going to be thrown out of their homes in America. 3,000 families shattered. Some percentage of those will end up in divorce. Some percentage of those will end up in spousal or child abuse. Some percentage of those will end up in suicides. Or homicides. Or burglaries. Or fill in the blanks. I mean, people who are homeless, who are jobless, who are penniless, who are broke, who have been basically wiped out and kicked out of the system. Not that I'm a big fan of the system, but they have no access to anything. Can behave rather desperately. And in the midst of this, we had this Values Voters Conference over the weekend. Now, it was on Yom Kippur, which is the day when Jews fast. I mean, don't even drink water. All day, you know, from Friday night till Saturday night. Don't drink water. Don't eat food. Don't leave the, you know, basically don't leave the house. Don't work. Don't even wear leather. That's the day that the Values Voters Summit decided to put on their summit. So it's pretty clear that it's not Judeo-Christian concepts that they're worried about. It is fundamentalist Christian concepts. And to the best of my knowledge, there's no indictment of homosexuality in the New Testament, if you want to get very Christian on this. But Jesus really was clear about what his values were. Go to read it in Matthew 25. Feed the hungry. Heal the sick. Clothe the naked, which would be the modern-day equivalent, would be house the homeless. Give water to the thirsty. Visit those in prison. None of those topics were on the Value Voters agenda. In fact, I would submit to you that the so-called Values Voters are anti-Christian because they're opposed to all those things. They're opposed to food stamps. They're opposed to federal housing assistance. They're opposed to national health care programs. They're opposed to all the things that Jesus was promoting. Instead, what they're all about is bigotry. In this case, they focused it all on Mitt Romney. Hooray.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In case you don't get it, and for those right-wingers who want to quote the show, that was a sarcastic hooray. But in any case, it's so ironic. Back with Columbus and your calls. The hour. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. I promised you a Genocide Day meditation, some quick thoughts on Columbus Day, and here they are. You will see this pop up over at truthout.org sometime later today, I'm guessing. You know, if you fly over Hispaniola, the island that is half Haiti, half Dominican Republic, the Haiti part looks like somebody just blew it off with a blowtorch. You know, the forest is just gone. And this was, well, that kind of leads into a whole other conversation. But basically what happened was Columbus, when he and his crew arrived in 1492, basically the entire island was a lush forest. And the Taino Indians, as he referred to them, he thought he had hit the west coast of or the east coast of India. And in fact, apparently went to his grave thinking that. They were not so happy about being rounded up and enslaved. Let me just share with you some of the things that Columbus's men, the men who were with him on his ships, wrote. One of them was kind of the official biographer. Another was his brother. Another was one of his senior officers. Let's go first to the senior officer, Christopher Columbus, the senior officer, Miguel Cuneo. He said, when they were when our caravels, that's their ships, were to leave for Spain, we gathered 1,600 male and female persons of these Indians And these we embarked in our caravels on February 17th, 1495. This was his second trip when he went back to take slaves. On February 17, 1495, for those who remained, those Spaniards who remained, we let it be known in the vicinity that anyone who wanted to take some of them could do so to the amount desired, which was done. Then Cuneo brags about how his good friend and the commander of the expedition, Christopher Columbus, gave him a beautiful teenage Carib girl as his personal slave, a personal gift from Columbus himself. And he said when he attempted to have sex with her, quote, this is quoting Cuneo, she resisted with all her strength. And so in his own words, quote, he thrashed her mercilessly and raped her, end quote. Now, Columbus made up this story about these people being cannibals, which was just a total fiction, although it's still taught in some of our schools, to justify his genocide. But the actual letter he sent to the Queen of Spain, Queen Isabella, in 1493, said, and I quote from Christopher Columbus, it is possible with the name of the Holy Trinity to sell all the slaves which it is possible to sell. Here there are so many of these slaves, and also Brazilwood, that although they are living things, they are as good as gold. In other words, he couldn't find any gold there, but he had some other cool stuff, slaves and Brazilwood. He began the sex slave trade, actually became the most important part of Columbus's business. As he wrote to a friend in 1500, now this was 8 years after his initial visit there, again, quoting Christopher Columbus himself, 100 castellanos, that's a Spanish coin that in today's money would be, you know, I don't know. Actually, I don't know its value. My guess would be probably like a $10 coin. But in any case, 100 castellanos are as easily obtained for a woman as for a farm. And it is very general, and there are plenty of dealers who go about looking for girls. Those from 9 to 10 years old are now in the greatest demand. End of quote from Christopher Columbus. But the Taino, the natives, the indigenous people of Hispaniola did not like being sex slaves, and they didn't want to work on plantations, and they basically resisted. So Columbus said, let's impose discipline on them. For even a minor offense, an Indian's nose or ear was cut off so that he could go back to his village and impress the people with the brutality that Columbus and the Spanish were capable of. Columbus attacked them with dogs, skewered them with pikes from, how do you say it delicately, from rear end to mouth. In other words, we just shove it through them and then carry them off on the pike dead at that point, and shot them. By 1517, the Taino had had it. This was 30 years into the occupation by Columbus. Many had fled the island. There are still Taino in that region. But by 1517, as Pedro de Cordoba, who was a kind of the historian of the time of the trip, wrote to King Ferdinand. I quote from his 1517 letter, quote, as a result of the sufferings and hard labor they endured, the Indians choose and have chosen suicide. Occasionally 100 have committed mass suicide. The women, exhausted by labor, have shunned conception and childbirth. Many, when pregnant, have taken something to abort and have aborted. Others, after delivery, have killed their children with their own hands so as not to leave them in such oppressive slavery. End of quote. From Pedro de Cordoba, Columbus's historian. Eventually, Columbus and later his brother Bartholomew, who he left, Christopher Columbus and his brother Bartholomew Columbus, who he left in charge of the island, simply resorted to wiping them out. Prior to his arrival, there were 1.5 to 3 million people. By 1496, it was down to 1.1 million, according to a census done by Bartholomew Columbus, By 1516, the population, the indigenous population, was 12,000. And according to Las Casas, another one of the crew members who was there, by 1542, there were fewer than 200 natives alive. By 1555, on that island, every single one was dead. And this, of course, is not just the story of Columbus. This is the story of our culture. For example, in the United States, the first Indian war in New England was the Pequot War. P-E-Q-U-O-T. Pequot. The Pequot War of 1636. Now, keep in mind, 1636. Europeans had settled this continent for about 40 years at that point. In which the colonists surrounded the largest of the Pequot villages, set it afire as the sun began to rise, and then performed their duty. They shot everybody, men, women, children, and the elderly who were trying to escape the flames. William Bradford, who has been quoted in many different ways, I believe he's the fellow that, I may be wrong on this, but I believe he's the fellow that Ronald Reagan originally quoted with the Shining City on the Hill statement. In any case, as Puritan colonist William Bradford described the scene, this is Bradford's own words. He was there. 1636. Quote, "It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire, and the streams of blood quenching the same, and horrible was the stink and scent thereof. But the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and the colonists gave praise thereof to God who had wrought so wonderfully." End of quote. Now, up until that point, the Narragansetts, who were a somewhat competitive tribe with the Pequots and had been friends with the colonists, up to that point they had associated with the colonists, had helped them out. They were so shocked by this example of genocide that they said, "We're not talking to you guys anymore." So Captain John Underhill wrote a letter ridiculing them, saying, Narragansett wars with those other tribes are more for pastime than to conquer and subdue enemies, end quote. Yes, it was the Iroquois Confederation that invented lacrosse. You can see a picture in one of the museums here in Washington, D.C., in the National Museum, of a lacrosse game that lasted 3 days long that had tens of thousands of Native Americans. And it was to settle a border dispute of some kind, and nobody was killed. Whoever won the game won the dispute. So, anyhow, we've got this kind of kill the infidels mentality. And now we're exporting it. Now we're taking this, we are the Uber culture. I mean, there's even an element of this in the melting pot theory that says, you know, anybody's welcome to come to the United States as long as they become culturally like British Europeans, basically, Anglo-Americans. It is the velvet glove over the iron fist of a dominator culture that says to people of color who speak in a way different than how I'm speaking right now, that, you know, they're not going to get the phone call for the job interview, or they're not going to, you know, fill in the blank. This is how it plays out in the United States, and not just the United States. And this is, you know, this kind of infected culture is apparently relatively unique to the last 7,000 years on virtually all continents. How do we wake up from this mental illness? Back with your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in the meantime, how do we create some jobs so that we can get A, people back to work, and B, end poverty, and C, bring back the middle class?
So goodbye, Columbus. We've honored you too long. A navigator extraordinaire, a sailor brave and strong. A human so inhuman as to wipe out a whole race. It's time we start remembering you for your proper wicked place. We've plenty to be proud of in our nation's history.
You tell him, Jim Turr.
Without extolling scoundrels who wrought such misery. In just those Caribbean isles, perhaps 3 million died. Including those who, rather than be slaves, chose suicide. Now I know I might not be here if you hadn't been here yourself.
That's
but
brilliant.
I might be even happier, and I might be somewhere else. And America might have grown up freer and quite differently. Instead of where we justify and celebrate slavery.
Yes, indeed. So welcome back. And tip of the hat to Jim Turr, who wrote and performed that, BlueCanyonProductions.com, if you want more of that. Jim said he was inspired by my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which has the information, by the way, that I just shared with you about Christopher Columbus. Mark, and just a quick thing that I want to tell you. I have a new book coming out probably this week, maybe next. It's called The Tom Hartman Reader. It's a compilation of kind of the best of pieces I've got 22 books in print. I'm not sure how many went into the reader. And it's frankly, I'm very proud of it. I think it's really cool. And so you might want to check it out if you enjoy reading my stuff. The Tom Hartman Reader, it should be available any day now on the online book sites and in the bookstores in the next week or three. Mark in Grand Rapids. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Tom, I'd like us, the 99%, to send a clear message to the 1% on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, the 70th year. All of us, every one of us, workers, students, all of us, stay home that day. Just take one day off, blue flu, call in sick, however you want to get yourself just home for that one day.
Mark, is this your idea, or is there a website out there that's
popped in? I haven't heard anybody else come up with it yet, Tom.
Yeah.
And you know what? If it's a good idea, it isn't mine. It came from the ethers.
Sure.
You know?
Well, and if it's a good idea, it may well go viral, and you just spoke it to 3 million people, Mark, so let's see what happens. The 70th anniversary of Pearl Harbor Day is December 7th of this year.
Yes, Wednesday.
Yeah. Because December 7th, 1941, when Pearl Harbor Day happened, right?
Yep.
If I
have
that right.
Tom, Gandhi
42,
brought the English
41.
To their knees with that one general strike.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it wasn't just one, actually. It was a series of them over a number of years. But you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
And it was a movement that slowly grew, just like we're seeing right now. Brilliant, Mark. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening to WTKG in Grand Rapids. Bruce. Hey, Bruce, I don't have a city for you. Where are you calling from?
Columbus, Ohio, actually.
Oh, great. What's up?
We're the good Columbus.
Yeah.
As you know, in Ohio next month, we're hoping to repeal Senate Bill 5, the anti-collective bargaining law.
Yes.
That was passed here. But what's also interesting is that it's not been on the radar, is that they're also on the ballot is a proposed constitutional amendment which would prohibit any person compelling them to purchase health insurance or forced to participate in a health insurance program. So I'm wondering, you know, this is clearly a strike at the, you know, at Obamacare.
Right.
And so I was wondering what your thoughts were about that. Could that then give us an opportunity to go to single payer like some of the other states were talking about?
Yeah, you know, there's the law of unintended consequences. The Republican, you know, the right wingers obviously put this on as a way of kicking Obamacare. But if it passes, there's two possible routes that could come out of that. One is that, or three arguably, one would be the status quo. The second would be that the state then is free to go you know, the state might get some kind of a waiver, as Vermont has asked for, as I believe Massachusetts has, as Montana just asked for, John Tester in Montana, because Vermont and Montana are both going to do basically Medicare Part E programs statewide. In other words, a single-payer health care systems. And if they got a waiver and the people, the good people of Ohio stood up and said, hey, this is what we want, you just never know, you know, what might come out of that.
Right.
And you know, the other possibility is that the Obama administration would fight it in court and it would end up before the Supreme Court, and or they would say this is, or the court, the state Supreme Court in Ohio would simply declare that it's a violation of the Constitution, you know, under the Supremacy Clause, and therefore strike it down.
Thanks.
So it's one of those we'll see things, right?
But absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the heads up on that, Bruce, and thanks for the call, and good on you in Columbus, Ohio. Keep up the struggle and keep up the fight. Great to hear from you. Thank you. Clara in Oakland, California. Hey, Clara, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to alert everybody in the Bay Area that we're having a march and rally for jobs, not cuts. This has been in the making for several months now before Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And this, it's going to happen this Saturday, October 15th. We have the support of labor, students, nurses, et cetera.
That is great. Is there a website for it, Clara?
Yes, there is. I'm going to give it to you right now. It's www.jobs-not-cuts.org.
Jobs-not-cuts.org. Great. Clara,
right. We'll be marching at 1 o'clock at Laney in Oakland at Laney College, and going to Frank Ogawa Plaza, and we're gonna, Danny Glover's going to be speaking, and we have the San Francisco Mime Troupe there, and we want a big turnout. So we've been working hard. This is with MoveOn.org and Rebuild the Dream in conjunction.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is very timely.
Okay.
I mean, it is. Solidarity with the
what I'm seeing is a thousand flowers blossoming. You know, it is happening all over the place. You've got everybody from you know, the anarchists to the Democratic Party. I mean, it's this whole spectrum who are saying enough already. And frankly, a fair number of Republicans and then Tea Partiers are probably tossing in too. So, Clara, good luck on your march and you know, I wish you the very best. Please call us back next week and let us know how it went. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. In the last hour, we went through I'm not going to repeat the whole thing, but a rather lengthy collection of letters from Christopher Columbus and his staff members. Most entertaining. Well, actually, it wasn't. It was really kind of depressing. And also, you know, what's going on with the Occupy Wall Street movement, the 99% movement. We'll get back to all of that in a few moments and your calls on it. But right now, Stephen Moore is back with us. He is an economist, the editorial board member and senior economics writer with the Wall Street Journal. You can find his blogs over at topics.wsj.com. Do I have that right, Stephen?
You got it.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
You wrote, "Is Keynes finally dead?" And you did quote him as saying, you know, ultimately we are all, what would he say? Ultimately we're all dead? What was the?
In the long run, we're all dead.
In the long run, we're all dead, yeah. And I thought that was an accurate quote, but I was surprised that when you started, you know, in your attack of Keynesian economics in the 1930s, that instead of choosing 1920, for example, 1936, you chose 1939, which is when he had, after 2 years of pressure from the Republicans, stopped Keynesian stimulus, and the unemployment rate had gone up from the 16.9% it was in 1936, which, by the way, if we were still calculating unemployment the way we did then, now, our unemployment rate would be 16.1%. So we were basically right there. And it went back up. Why?
Well, if you look over that whole period from the Depression started, obviously, in 1929. Roosevelt took office in 1933. The unemployment rate during Roosevelt's whole presidency until 1941, when World War II started, was above 10%. So there was no time when there was any respite from, there were slight, variations in unemployment rate, but it was still by far the worst decade in 100 years for unemployment. And my point was that I don't think any of those programs, if you just look at the evidence, that there was any evidence that the, all the spending actually created jobs or created a recovery.
Well, we went in 1932, the unemployment rate was 23.6%.
Right.
34, it was down to 21%. By 36, it was down to 16%. That's pretty
horrible.
Massive shift.
That's horrible. I mean,
well,
you know,
yeah, it's horrible in the context of every 80-year Great Depression event. But.
Yeah, but I guess my point is, like, this is the problem I have with people saying now, like, we're in a Great Depression. The reason the Depression lasted so long was because every policy out of Washington was exactly the wrong thing to do. Just like right now, the reason this recession has been so horrible, and I was listening to your numbers on, you know, how, you know, the incomes of families have actually gone down more in the, quote, recovery than during the recession itself. I mean, that's an indictment of the fact that we've done all these policies that have really ruined the economy.
But we're not pursuing Keynesian economics right
now. Well, sure we are. We're running $1.5 trillion deficit.
The deficit spending is only a small part of Keynesian economics, and it's only if it's necessary to fund it. The point of, you know, that's just like, where do you get the money if you have to get the money? The fact of the matter is that, you know, if you want to say that, then you'd have to say Reagan was a Keynesian because he took us from basically a flatline debt that we'd had since George Washington. You know, it hadn't bumped when you adjusted for real inflation outside of a couple of world wars through 200 years and tripled it. And then George Herbert Walker Bush, who added another, you know, couple billion to it. And then George W. Bush, who added another $5 billion to it. Are they Keynesians?
Yeah, look, there's no question there was a Keynesian element to the Reagan expansion. But the main...
So then you're acknowledging Keynesian.
The main impetus for the expansion in the 80s wasn't a Keynesian deficit. It was the marginal tax rate reductions, which is why what the Senate is going to vote on tomorrow is so silly. They're going to vote to raise tax rates, which is, you know, put us in a...
Well, to the extent that Reagan lowered taxes on working people, and he did once, he raised them then seven times. But
yeah, but the taxes were much lower. I mean, that was the biggest tax cut in history.
But that's Keynesian, too.
Yeah, but
I mean,
but
let me just ask you a really simple question, Stephen. What got us out of the Great Depression?
Okay, here's the thing.
What got us out of the Great Depression?
Let me answer that with this question about the Reagan deficits. Those deficits were half as large as the deficits that Obama is running. Reagan's average deficits were 4% of GDP. Obama's running.
Right, because Reagan didn't have 30 years of right wingers before him, creating a situation where he had to shoot Santa Claus.
You know,
I understand that, Stephen. But what do you think got us out of the Great Depression?
What got us out of the Great Depression?
Right.
It wasn't until World War II started that
So World War II got us out of the Great Depression, right?
Yeah, because you put 3 million people in uniform.
Okay, so that sounds to me like the biggest government spending program ever.
Oh, but you know,
it sounds to me like you're proving Keynes.
There's no question people act completely differently. The whole economy adjusts to a wartime economy during the 1940s. You know, so the normal economic rules are thrown out when you've got an enemy at your gates. Yeah, people will act patriotically. They will pay 95% tax rate.
So what you're saying? Well, the 95% tax rate was actually put into place by Herbert Hoover. You'll recall.
Well, I don't know, but
before Franklin Roosevelt came along,
hardly a vindication.
And before
Keynesianism, to say the World War II got us out of the Great Depression,
I think it's an absolute vindication of it.
I mean,
and think how much look at how much federal spending increased as a consequence of World War II.
Hugely up, but that's because everybody mobilized, every citizen.
It put everybody to work
for a great war.
Right, you're explaining Keynes's theory. Keynes said, if you hire one guy to dig a hole and another guy to fill it, then at the end of the day, what's going to happen?
People act completely differently during a period of wartime than they do during peace. People,
they don't.
People are going to pay 90% tax rates during a period of peace. People will act.
Then why was it that during the greatest expansion in the history of this country, during the 1950s, when a Republican Dwight Eisenhower was president, or during the 1960s, when you had Nixon and in the 70s, why was it that during those three decades of the largest decade-by-decade GDP expansion, literally since George Washington, Every single one was over 3.1%. During those three decades, the top marginal tax rate was either 95% or 74%.
Wait a minute. First of all, the 70s was the worst decade for family incomes over the last. If you look,
I'm talking about GDP expansion.
Well,
I'm talking about the economy
really
overall.
What people care about is their incomes. Incomes crashed during the 70s, and so did asset prices fell. I mean, people got
incomes began to flatten out in 1978, and you had the Arab oil boycott. The cost of energy shot up massively, and the bill for the Vietnam War became due.
God forbid, Tom, that we return to the 1970s.
But, Stephen,
that was a horrible decade.
We're going to, because we're doing the exact same thing right now with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Bush's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that we did with Johnson and Nixon's wars in Vietnam. They were put on the credit card, and they're going to have to be paid.
Right. I mean,
and when they have to be paid, you're going to have inflation, and you're going to have unemployment.
And the problem we made in the 60s, and we're repeating that mistake now, is that when you have to spend more money on guns, you spend less money on butter. And it's interesting, when you talked about the 1940s, look at what happened to all those government domestic programs in the 1940s. They all were totally eviscerated. I mean,
they were dialed back to the extent.
Every single penny was spent on the war effort.
Not true, Stephen. Not true at all.
Yeah, those government programs went away.
They shrank because their labor force was sent overseas.
Yeah, because
the government was spending more money. If just for a second, and we have less than a minute, but just a very very simple question: if we had taken all that money that we spent on World War II, mm-hmm. and instead of using it to drop bombs on Dresden, we'd used it to build schools and roads. Do you think that would have gotten us out of World War II or out of the Great Depression?
No, because we tried that. That's what Roosevelt had tried from 1932 to 1940.
So it wasn't the spending. It was somehow killing people gets us out of depressions.
There's no such thing as a free lunch. If the government spends a dollar, it has to come from somewhere.
And it only gets us out of depressions if it involves killing people.
If we're under attack and you mobilize for a whole out military effort, yeah, people will work 70 hours a week. They will pay 95% tax rates. They'll do anything.
So the solution is to declare another war?
That's your solution. What you're saying is that we need another World War II to get this. What I'm saying is we should try what Reagan did, which is cut tax rates, deregulate.
Reagan borrowed three times the existing national debt. Are you suggesting that Barack Obama should borrow $23 trillion?
Yeah, well, wait a minute. The debt is now bigger than it was, much bigger than under Reagan. The deficits are twice as big.
Hold on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, Steve, we're out of time, but topicswsj.com, Stephen Moore. Stephen, thank you for being with us. Yep, I guess he's gone. Talk to you for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. John in North Hollywood, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, John, what's up?
Hello.
Hey, John, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm calling. I was listening to KTLK. Anyway, the reason why I wanted to call was the connection between Columbus and the Occupy protests.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that the connection is forgiveness for those of the 1% who existed in Columbus's day also, let alone our day now, and the ability to make them part of the 99%, sort of 99% and growing movement.
Yeah.
They all need, it needs to be 100%, and we need to forgive for these past injustices.
Well, I think you need to do one of two things before forgiving. Either there needs to be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Somebody needs to point out what they did and acknowledge it to the people that they did it to and apologize for it. Or there need to be prosecutions, particularly for the banksters who have thrown so many people out of their homes, just to make a profit. But I do agree with you, John. I think that there is a connection. I think that the banksters, the top 1%, the banksters represent that. Wetsuko is the word that Professor Forbes, Jack Forbes, recently deceased, of the University of California, anthropology professor. I quoted him. This all this stuff that I just shared with you is in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, that he was the guy who informed me about this. He was professor of Native American Studies. And I would submit that that mindset, that rob, rape, pillage mindset, is alive and well on Wall Street today. And that's what people are pushing back on. And a good thing it is. Jacob in Chicago. Hey, Jacob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to follow up on what the young lady from Oakland was speaking about. There are a series of jobs not cuts demonstrations going on across the country. They're all coordinated for the same time, so that 1 o'clock in Oakland is 4 o'clock here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And ours is starting from the Hilton Hotel in 720 South Michigan. And what's unusual about ours here is that we're going to end up demonstrating outside of a convention of mortgage security bankers and commodities futures traders. It's
cool.
Here in Chicago.
I think 1 o'clock, by the way, I think 1 o'clock in Oakland would be 3 o'clock in Chicago. But because Oakland.
Well, whatever.
Yeah.
Ours is at 4 p.m. Just
okay.
So that anybody in Chicago listening, it's
okay.
At 4 p.m. And we're gathering at the Hilton Hotel at 720 South Michigan downtown. And we encourage everybody to go. And it's
great.
A cooperative effort between Move On and Alex Jones, or yeah, Alex Jones' Rebuild America movement.
Yeah, it's. I don't think it would be the Alex Jones of the kind of right wing talk radio. It's somebody else that you're talking about, but
yeah, the other fellow.
Yeah, the website is jobs-not-cuts.org. Is it the same website? Does it list all of them?
No, that one is specifically for Oakland. You can go to moveon.org, and there's a link in the upper left-hand corner of the home page for Jobs Not Cuts, and you can find one near you by
using
that link.
Okay, Jacob, thanks for the heads up. Much appreciated. Great
to hear
from you. Thank you. David in Ithaca, New York, listening to WNYY. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Actually, I had a slogan with regard to the Occupy Wall Street, but since you were talking about genocide today.
Well, today is genocide day, so, yeah.
Right, exactly. I found myself in Spain a few years ago, and in the foyer to the Prado, which is their big art museum in Madrid.
I've been there.
There's actually a statue up on a pedestal of a conquistador. And on his, at his feet, which he's stepping on, is an indigenous person in chains.
Yep.
My head was going to explode when I saw this thing.
Yep.
I couldn't believe it.
Yep.
It's outrageous. But anyway, I wanted to ask, I thought of a slogan that I thought might be useful. I wanted to ask your opinion of it with respect to the Occupy Wall Street, which is underregulated capitalism is organized crime.
Well, I would not disagree with the bumper sticker that said that, but you know, I think the reality is a little more nuanced. Underregulated capitalism provides a space in which a form of organized crime that is arguably not criminal but should be can take root and grow, and that's what we've seen in the United States over the last 30 years.
Yes. Oh, yes. Exactly. I mean, you're right. It is a little simplistic, but I thought it might be a little bit more credible than eat the rich.
Yeah. No. Simplistic is great for bumper stickers, and I think that's great. Good one. Good one, David. Thank you very much for sharing it. Nate in Colon, Michigan. Hey, Nate. What's up?
Hi. I just wanted to talk about Columbus for a second here. His first voyage to the Americas, since he did not find any gold, he took several hundred slaves back to Spain.
Right.
And roughly half of them died on the voyage from various things like, you know, some of them disease, of course, some of them just, you know, seemed like depression and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm a good number from just mistreatment.
Yeah, and those who were most non-compliant were beaten to death or were thrown overboard or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just sick that we celebrate this guy's quote-unquote discovery of America.
Yeah.
I guess that's
let me add a final irony to this, Nate. Do you know what he was offered by the Queen if he was successful in finding gold on this, on his trip? He was offered a pension.
Oh.
A lifetime pension.
Jeez.
He was offered Social Security.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that ironic?
That was unheard of. Yeah.
Yeah, because back in those days, you know, you made what you made, and then, you know, when you got old, you fell to the diseases and deprivations of the time. Nate, thanks a lot for the call. It's why do we celebrate Columbus's birthday? Well, we've been telling ourselves, we Americans have been telling ourselves a lot of stories about ourselves for a long time, and there are some stories that we don't tell, like why this district that I'm living in is called the District of Columbia. More on that right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it has actually not a great deal to do with Columbus. Stick around. Scone alert for the day. What do you do if you're a small-time lounge singer on cruise ships and small-time crook, and you have an opportunity to get into a business deal with a partner who later ends up in prison? He's in prison right now for his corrupt business deals. And the guy helps you buy a newspaper, and then you buy another newspaper, and then a radio station, then another radio station, then another TV station, then another TV network, and then a TV network, and then a radio network, and then another radio network, then another TV network, and another newspaper. Pretty soon you end up owning over 90% of all the media that is read, seen, or heard in the country of Italy. What do? You run for prime minister. That's what Silvio Berlusconi did. So, our Berlusconi alert for the day. George Clooney has spoken for the first time about meeting Silvio Berlusconi. Clooney said, I had one evening with Berlusconi, and it was one of the more astonishing evenings of my life. I went to speak about Darfur. Afterwards, he took me to see his bedroom and the bed that Putin had given him. Clooney added, it became a very different evening than anyone thought. I was like, I have to go. And he was saying, no, where are you going? There's going to be a party. And I was like, no, I got to go. I really do. Berlusconi's lawyers want Clooney to refute claims by a teenager, an exotic dancer whose nickname is Ruby the Heart Stealer, that he was at one of the premier's Bunga Bunga parties in Milan. Berlusconi's denied all charges relating to the case. Clooney says he never attended one of the parties. Did he or didn't he? You know, if it comes down to taking George Clooney's word for something or Silvio Berlusconi's, I'm with George Clooney every day of the week. It's just that simple. Marie in Seattle. Hey, Marie, what's up?
Hi, I was calling about the economist columnist you had on.
Yes, Stephen Moore.
His thinking that taxes need to even be lower, and I wonder what kind of country that they and the right wing, the Republicans, want, where we pay no taxes, so we keep what we make. But if you're making minimum wage, how are you going to afford all the things that you need to do when they privatize everything, where you have to pay to use your roads, your libraries, your schools, your parks, your fire departments, your police? How is anybody going to afford that?
The world that they want to take us back to is the Gilded Age, the latter years of the late 19th century, the 19th century, the late 1800s.
And was it Herman Cain that said, if you're not rich, it's your fault?
Yeah. Yeah, and fire departments were, in fact, privatized back then. And if you didn't have the shield in front of your house that indicated that you'd paid your annual dues and your house caught on fire, they'd just drive on by and they would ignore it. And, people, there was no right of public school. People, you know, sometimes communities would get together and build schools and sometimes not. And a lot of young kids just never went to school. They started working at 8 or 9. In fact, the Supreme Court in, I think it was 1913, might have been 1912, but it was in the 19-teens, maybe 1917. The Supreme Court was ruled on a case where the argument was that children under the age of 14 should not be allowed to work because, you know, that's just wrong. And, in fact, the age of 8 was considered the age at which children could legally go to work. And the Supreme Court ruled against the children and said that it would be a violation of the child's right to contract under the Constitution. Very libertarian, you know, right down the, you know, this is the kind of thing Rand Paul and Ron Paul would just love. It was against, it was a violation of the child's right to contract to say that they couldn't work if they were 14 years of old age or younger. And that, in, back in that day, included in the brothels. So, it, I mean, that's the world that I think, I can't speak for Stephen Moore, but I can tell you that, you know, when you talk to the folks from the Objectivist Institute, the Ayn Rand Institute, AynRand.org, organizations like that, and you ask them what was the greatest period of American history, they will say, you know, when the railroads were rising, the period of the robber barons. And we had this huge separation. The average, in the census of 1900, the average annual American income in today's dollars, adjusted for today's dollars, was in the neighborhood of $10,000. And, you know, so about a fifth. People, the average person was about as fifth as well off or as wealthy as we are. So we had a huge working poor, a very, very small middle class, which was basically doctors and lawyers, and small shop owners, and a very small but incredibly wealthy elite. And that's what they want to take us back to. Marie, thanks for the call. Thanks for pointing that out. It's you know, well said, well done. Terry in Gulfport, Mississippi. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I like what you had to say, you know, because I've realized that a long time ago, the fact that they want to bring this country back to 1913 and have us all live, you know, like that, where you actually had to have the whole family working to do anything.
Yeah. No, we you know, in the 1980s, actually late 70s. I mean, Carter drank the deregulation Kool-Aid the last 2 years of his administration, and then Reagan put it on steroids. And so, starting roughly around 1978, but you know, through the 80s in particular. We and the 90s, we went from one person being able to support a family to requiring two. And you're absolutely right. In the 19th century, it took three or four or five people. And it's one of the reasons why people had so many kids is because each one of those kids could, you know, if in the farm economy in the pre-1880s, they could work in the farm. And in the industrial economy, they could go to work in the factories if they went into the cities. You're absolutely right, Terry. Excellent point. David in Mukilteo, Washington. It says you disagree with me. What's up, David?
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
Well, I'll comment on your last caller. The reason I didn't want to talk about this, but the reason that people, that children don't have to work is because of productivity increases, not because of laws. So, but anyway, I want
that's
to
a nice fantasy,
about,
but the fact of the matter is that children,
you know,
were working until it was outlawed.
Increases. I mean, the reason kids had to work is because productivity was so low. But anyway, that's economics,
it's,
that you guys don't understand.
It's not the case, actually, and I defy you to demonstrate it. And beyond that,
productivity increases.
if you look at the movement to end child labor in the later part of the 19th and early 20th century, there were two parties to that movement to end child labor. One was organized labor, who saw children as competition in the workplace, and they knew if they could get children out of the workplace, it would drive up wages. And that was the reason why organized labor wanted children out of the workplace. And then you had large movements that were largely organized by women who thought that it was simply immoral that children have to work and not be able to go to school. And the result of the alliance,
that's all a mute point if the productivity is not high enough. If families have to produce, the reason kids went to work on a farm is because you didn't have farm equipment. Period. That's called productivity increases. But anyway, I want to talk to you about Keynesianism and your guys' adoption of this ideology actually hurt your own constituents, because Keynes, in trying to create demand, wanted to print money. And that printing of money creates a tremendously highly regressive inflation tax, which actually destroys your own constituents.
Keynes was not an advocate for inflation.
He
was not an advocate for printing money. He was an advocate for borrowing money, which is a different thing.
I knew you were going to say that.
Have you read the general theory?
Printing money.
David, have you read the general theory? Have you read the general theory?
Yes.
Okay, then please go back, because I have two. Please go back to that book and find the part where Keynes says that he's in favor of printing money, and call back on this program. I will put you on the air. But, you know, it is, if you're going to misrepresent John, now, John Maynard Keynes did, I mean, I suppose you could excerpt from what he was saying, even supply side economics. I mean, you know, he was kind of all over the map in some areas, but the general theory, the what we call aggregate demand, what he called effective demand, this was a revolution in thinking, in economic thinking. It used to be that the thinking about economic cycles was that when cycles crashed, that when economies crashed, that wages would crash. As wages crashed, then factories weren't able to sell things, and so they would lower their prices. They would lower their prices, and as they were lowering their prices and as they were making fewer things, there was less demand for capital. And so interest rates would drop because the banks would want to lend out more capital, right, because they had more money and they had to spend. So it was like all competition. And that eventually wages would drop to the point where the employers would start hiring and interest rates would drop to the point where employers would start borrowing and the economy would jumpstart again. And what we saw from a series of cycles, and Keynes looked at these cycles of boom and bust in the United States, we, from the time George Washington was president until the time Franklin Roosevelt was president, we never went more than 15 years in the United States without a major bank crash or panic. Never, ever, ever. And he looked at those cycles and he said, you know, there's a way to smooth these cycles out. You're not looking at aggregate demand. You're only looking at one particular unique type of demand. And he said that there's a psychological component to that demand as well as an actual practical physical component. And somebody has to be the employer of last resort. Somebody has to be the creator of demand of last resort. And the only person the only entity that he could come up with or that anybody has ever come up with is government. And how does government create demand? They can do it one of two ways. They can buy things, or they can hire people. And when government hires people or buys things, building roads and infrastructure and hiring people to do them, in that case, government is doing both. When government does that, then what happens is that people end up with money in their pockets and they want to buy things. And that stimulates demand. And demand then drives the economy. Keynesian economics is very simple. And you know, it works. It's been demonstrated over and over.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more. Talk Radio News is off today. Back with your calls right after this. 45 minutes, best thing. I don't. So I find it particularly interesting, welcome back by the way, I find it particularly interesting that here in Washington, D.C. over the weekend, one of the various organizations or groups or whatever you want to call it, marches decided to go off to visit the Air and Space Museum because they have a drone exhibit there. And this group was opposed to the wars. I share that opposition. And said, you know, let's go picket or protest this. And this right wing, he's an associate editor at the American Spectator. Assistant editor is his title. And this assistant editor at the American Spectator, it's been interesting to see if he's still an assistant editor. If this was, you know, Patrick Howley is his name. If he was hired to do this or if he just took it on himself. But you can watch the video. Here's this right way. And he actually wrote about it after the fact that he was so proud of the fact that, you know, he was right up there on the edge of the thing. So anyhow, we're going to have a guest about this in the next hour. Who was there, and we'll get into that in more detail. John in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I love your show, and I wanted to ask about, you know, yeah, the conservatives want to take us back to the Gilded Age, where it was essentially a feudal society, right?
Yes, I mean, F-E-U-D-A-L. Yes, although for working people, it was feudal as well.
Why are, I mean, And of course, you know, their political rhetoric is essentially trying to hide all that, and they're saying, oh, it's the free market, when really it's not the free market. I mean, they're using the government to bring that situation about, correct? Would you say? I mean, they're, you know, the Supreme Court is helping them, all the different policies.
Yeah, and there are, and in fact, there are some regulations that are put into place, in fact, perhaps even many, that are put into place at the behest of big business to make it very, very difficult for small businesses to compete with them, or even medium-sized businesses.
Sure. Yes. And then also the, you know, right-to-work laws, which make collective bargaining.
I call them right-to-work for less. Yeah.
Right. I mean, wouldn't you say, like, collective bargaining is really, you know, in a free labor market, you know, collective bargaining, you know, when you look at our history, it is naturally coming, you know, workers figure out that works, especially when they're dealing with a corporation. So.
Well, it's a simple law. If capital can aggregate, in other words, if a bunch of people with money can get together and pool their money and use that on one side of the equation as the company, then the workers that they are hiring to be productive, to produce the goods that they're going to make money off of with the investment of that the capitalists are going to make money off of with the investment of their capital, those workers should also be allowed to aggregate, you know, to pool together, and that's called a union, and they balance each other, and actually in a functional regulated capitalist environment where you have pre-Taft-Hartley, where you have the ability of workers to unionize without constraint, you know, with the absolute force of government behind them, as the, you know, they absolutely have a legal ability to unionize. I mean, we went from virtually no unionization in 1930 to 34% unionization in 1947. It was the peak of the union movement, 34-35%, the year that Taft-Hartley got passed. And then Taft-Hartley created the right to work for less states, and you began the slow disintegration of labor movement from that point forward.
Right.
But yeah.
Quick question though, why are the conservatives, what is their philosophical foundation for having a, you know, essentially a banana republic type of society?
It's really easily explained. And what's so funny is that this is what they always accuse liberals of, which is a classic case of either Freudian projection or misdirection. And it is that they believe in an elite few governing the many. They believe in the doctrine of original sin, that all men are born sinners, that only a few of us are actually good people, that everybody else is fundamentally evil, and that as Thomas Hobbes in Leviathan laid it out in 1634, when he wrote about the original state of man before there was either the iron fist and constraining force of church or state, right? Before that, the life of man was short, nasty, brutish, I forget the whole quote,
right.
But
sure.
No arts, sure. No letters, no means of movement, no means of commerce. I mean, he had this long paragraph. And so if you really and truly believe that most people are evil and that there are only a few noble people, then the corollary of that belief is that the job of government must be to figure out who are the truly good people and put them in charge. And
right.
Then the question becomes, how do you figure out who the good people are? Because if you can't trust the voters in mass, because the voters are all evil people, then you want to try and disenfranchise as many of the voters as possible and only have good or semi-good people deciding who's the best person. Well, how do you do that? And that takes us back to this Calvinist notion that Thomas Jefferson railed about in his letters, right, that people who have money are blessed by God, if you're using the religious model, or people who have money have demonstrated intellectual capacity, and using either model, they are the good ones, they are the ones who should rule. And that was the debate between basically Adams and Hamilton on one side and Jefferson and Madison on the other side. Jefferson and
right.
Madison believed that the people, and they were following John Locke, who contradicted Hobbes. Hobbes said in 1634, all men are basically evil, there's a few who are good among us. John Locke, in his second treatise on government in 1675, I think, 16, whatever it was, in the 1670s, he came out and said, no, everybody's equal, and everybody has the potential to be good, and everybody should have the right to life, liberty, and property. And Jefferson appropriated that phrase and replaced property with the right of happiness. And
right.
So,
right. Yeah.
You know, that's been the argument in this country literally since we began.
From day one, you're right. And I think, you know, the Federalists, weren't they, I mean, on the one hand, they were against sort of the absolute power of royalty, okay?
They were not monarchists, but the High Federalists.
But they still felt that there had to be an elite group to,
absolutely,
to control everybody.
Absolutely.
And the people
and,
with them.
Yeah, and the Federalists degenerated into the High Federalists in the later part of the 18th century and the early 19th century. And the High Federalists were about as close to monarchists as you could get. And you had Alexander Hamilton all along saying the president should be appointed for life, you know, that monarchy actually is a good thing. And he made that proposal at the Constitutional Convention and got hooted down. He was so humiliated by it, he left town and didn't come back for a month. You know, that was what America repudiated in the election of 1800. Thanks, Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And much publicized police violence in New York with the kettling, is what they call it in the UK, the herding of these women into small groups, some of them being pepper sprayed by Officer Anthony and Tony Bologna, and the Brooklyn Bridge. And something, well, actually, I'd say it's something a little different, but it involved pepper spray happened here in Washington, D.C. over the weekend. And Dennis Traynor was there. And Dennis, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
You are an organizer of the October 2011. That's the Freedom Square group as opposed to the, well, to the McPherson Square group, I guess. Right?
Yes, correct. We began our occupation here at Freedom Plaza October 6th, which was the eve of the beginning of the second decade of the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. We went to redress our grievances to the government, specifically to bring all troops home and redirect those resources towards human and environmental needs.
Right. So, you were host of the video series Acronym, served as a writer and media consultant for Denis Kucinich's 2008 presidential campaign. And your documentary in U.S. Foreign Policy is called Manifest Destiny's Child. It was released in January this year. So to get the intro stuff out of the way, Dennis, what happened on Saturday?
Saturday we marched to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum specifically to do a banner drop and a mass die-in under a drone exhibit there. We didn't think that museums should be fetishizing weapons of mass destruction like drones. The march turned out to be much larger than we expected. We had about 1,000 people or more. People were joining us from the streets. There's been almost universal embracing of our movement here in D.C. We got to the museum. As we were coming up the stairs, the security guards rushed out of the first doors as some of us were entering into the vestibule. The security guards physically pushed the first line of us back, which those of us trained in nonviolence are trained to handle and trained to de-escalate situations like that.
Right, you do that by basically what? Just sitting down or doing what you're told, basically?
Sitting down or doing what we're told. Our objective was not to shut down the Air and Space Museum. Our objective was to demonstrate to the public there and open a dialogue about what exactly we are looking at up in the museum.
Right, but there was a guy by the name of Patrick Howley in your crowd who had a different agenda, it seems.
He had a different agenda, and he actually, I believe, got into the past the security, but next to him, and there's a photograph of this on the Daily Kos accounting of this that I saw, was a gentleman by the name of Hamzai, who we've identified, or who goes by the name of Hamzai, we've identified. He was with us in Freedom Plaza for several days. He was right in front of me. When he was pushed back, he reacted he redoubled the force. He grabbed the security guard by the shoulders, physically pushed him back, and that is when the pepper spray came out. So I got hit with pepper spray, and about 20 other people were affected by pepper spray as well. So I'm not sure if that person was working with the writer or just happened to be in close proximity, but they were together. The writer wasn't the incitor of violence. The other gentleman was, this gentleman going by the name of Hamzai. We've isolated him here in the plaza and made it clear that he's not welcome, and we are a nonviolent, peaceful resistance movement.
So who is this Patrick Howley who was standing next to him and who has and tell us who he is and what he's been bragging about?
Well, from what I can tell, he's a right-wing editor of a right-wing blog, and he specifically set out not to pursue his own agenda, but to undermine ours. So I've been having a lot of discussions with people like Patrick. One of the issues that we disagree on is healthcare. Patrick would like to see people, one of the 50 million people who don't have healthcare in this country, like to give them the complete works of Ayn Rand, a shotgun, and a pat on the back. We want to give people healthcare. So Patrick's agenda, which he is bragging about, unbelievably, is to incite violence in order to undermine what we're doing.
Wow. And that's what happened on Saturday.
That's what happened on Saturday. Like I said, the gentleman who I suspect was working with Patrick, although there's really no way for me to confirm that, but they were close together. They're pictured together. Physically instigated violence. Last night he was going around the plaza telling people, as our permit was running out, that if the police entered, that we should violently resist. So he is actively in our plaza trying to recruit people. Luckily for us, we have laid the groundwork, and the type of people that we've attracted here understand and are committed to nonviolent resistance.
Wow. I've told this story before, but what the hell. I was in SDS in the 60s, and there was always a couple of crazies at every meeting, particularly the public meetings, you know, where we'd get together outside the student union at MSU or whatever. And there was this one guy who was always saying, you know, we got to burn down the building, we got to kill the pigs, we got to, you know, whatever. I mean, he was always using very violent rhetoric and arguing in favor of very, very confrontational methods. And we all just thought he was crazy, although there was a splinter that ended up going in his direction and became the Weather Underground. Not specifically because of him or whatever, but when I think it was Brad Lang, it was one of the SDS guys, sued the Michigan State Police Department to get the Red Squad files to find out, you know, what was going on. This was like a decade later. We discovered that that guy was a police officer.
Yeah, and I asked this gentleman last night when he was in the plaza trying to recruit people for violence, point blank, he was a police officer. I think there was once a day where if you asked someone that question in an activist meeting, they had to be honest with you. I don't think that's still true anymore. He denied
it.
I don't know if he's just a hothead Tea Party activist or if he's embedded. But the thing is, we know that we're going to be infiltrated. I'm standing in the plaza now. There are 700 or 800 people, and I know that a certain number of them are infiltrators. So we have to just act with a certain amount of transparency. Otherwise, we're going to fester paranoia. We all trust each other.
Sure.
There are certain elements of nonviolent civil resistance that we'll have to plan with a little bit of secrecy, but 99% of what we do is completely transparent. We have nothing to hide. We're willing to risk arrest and get arrested and come back again and again and again and again, hold this plaza to address our grievances to the broken representative democracy.
And you know, also, would you not agree that there will be some people who absolutely share your values and your perspectives and yet believe that, you know, to bringing down the machine or confronting the machine in a way that demonstrates the violence of the machine is necessary. I mean, that was the rhetoric that I heard from the people who became the Weather Underground back in the day. And they were, you know, so not only do you have the infiltrators that you have to deal with, but you also have people on your own side who, because of the way they were brought up or how they think or whatever, they think that, you know, fighting back, you know, fight fire with fire is the way to do it.
Well, it's an interesting argument, and you can approach it on a moral level or on a strategic level. Morally, I would say that if you want to live in a free and open society that's free of violence, you should begin to live your life as if you live in a free and open society that's free of violence. Strategically, however, we've seen what happened in New York. People were pepper sprayed, people were kettled, no one reacted with violence, and that draws sympathy to your side.
Yep.
Nonviolent confrontations with police where people are only trying to find their voice is just going to grow their numbers. So New York is exploding right now, primarily because they have been able to maintain a nonviolent stance.
Yep.
If
Dennis, we have about 20 seconds left. You guys getting ready for the winter?
we're getting ready for the winter. We're not going anywhere. We're not going, and Congress is back in session tomorrow after the holiday, and they can expect to hear from us.
Okay. All right. Good luck, Dennis. October2011.org is the website, and then, of course, there's OccupyWallStreet.org, and there's a bunch of others as well. Dennis, good work. Keep it up. Say hi to everybody there for me, would you? Dennis? I think Dennis is gone. Okay. Anyhow, we'll be right back. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Genocide Day. Excuse me, happy Columbus Day. We'll be back with your calls right now. Brought to you in part by Solar World. SolarWorld.com for information on solar electricity. Happy Columbus Day. Happy Genocide Day. Tom Hartman here with you. William in Livonia, Louisiana. Hey, William, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to tell you that I put up a sign like Sam did. I put up a We Are the 99% in Livonia. And, Occupy Everywhere, because 1 in 6 children in America don't have enough to eat.
Yep.
I just wanted to tell you that after BP did it so bad, you know, they stamped our high school with a BP sign on top of it.
You're kidding.
And then number two, when y'all argue economics, I would like to sometimes hear about Dr. Nash when he wrote that paper about governing dynamics. From MIT and won a Nobel Peace Prize for it.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that, William, but if you go over to TomHartman.com, you can post a comment on my daily blog. I do read that, all the comments there every day and the links and stuff like that. I typically don't comment on them, but I read them. William, thank you for the call and thanks for the information. Mary in Tavares, Florida?
Yes, hi, Tom, and thank you for your wonderful work.
You're welcome. What's up?
Dennis made some great points. I'm from Florida, Central Florida, near the Village Idiots. You and I have spoken about that before, and the Tea Party. And since our 2000 election, we know that things happen. People do infiltrate and may try to cause strife. It's an awesome time right now to be alive and active. And I think we really might want to look at some leadership. To help us to come up with a clearly stated mission, and to definitely undermine attempts, for anyone to try to make this into anything but a peaceful, Fourth Amendment right to, assemble and protest.
Yeah.
I strongly suggest that we boycott Christmas this year and hurt them in the pocket. That's about the only thing that they understand.
You know, yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, sir.
Well, no, finish your thought. My apologies.
Well, the leadership I had in mind would definitely be loosely based. You are definitely my pick, as well as Michael Moore, Amy, Bernie Sanders, Van Jones, any and all. Form a loosely intelligent, progressive caucus of leadership, so that they don't have us looking like we're trying to be anything but peacefully assembled.
Well, I'm very pleased that these groups are essentially leaderless right now, and that this is a grassroots organization that's coming from the ground up. Eventually, people will emerge. I mean, it always happens. Every movement eventually finds its voice. And it finds its people.
A fair playing field, sir.
Yeah, and you hope that it's not, you know, the voices of the people who have the emotional need to be the voice, as opposed to somebody who has, you know, the practical wisdom to be the voice. But I'm not volunteering for that, and nor would I serve if elected. But I think that over time, what we're going to see is that this experiment in direct democracy will probably slowly morph into an experiment in representative democracy. But that's just a guess, just from having seen movements. You know, the civil rights movement is the one that everybody's probably most familiar with, over time, that eventually, you know, those voices do come out. As to the boycotting Christmas, let me point out that Adbusters was who started and who owns the website, OccupyWallStreet.org. Adbusters started this whole thing with the suggestion that Wall Street be occupied. They expected it to be, I don't know, a one-day thing or a week thing or whatever. It has turned into this giant thing, and
well,
it's spreading all over
too,
the world.
I love Reverend Billy,
too, what he does. Oh, Reverend Billy is wonderful. Yeah, he is absolutely wonderful.
Hurts. That's the only thing they understand.
Yeah, I'm in a movie with Reverend Billy. He's such a cool guy.
Oh, awesome.
But the point is that Adbusters has every year a Buy Nothing Day, which is the day after Thanksgiving, where they say Buy Nothing, and because that's Black Tuesday or Black Friday, right? It's the day that everybody's supposed to go out and buy things. And in fact, it wasn't last year, but I think it was the year before or the year before that, they tried to make a significant media buy on all the networks for Buy Nothing Day, saying don't buy anything today.
And they couldn't get the space.
That's right. The networks turned them down. So, Mary, thank you for the call. Excellent point. But, you know, Adbusters, brilliant people, great organization, totally support them. And, transparency, I've written for Adbusters. But they're great people. Let's see here. Mike in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for being there. We are saturated with Choose the Right radio stations out here that simulcast Fox News on six different stations, and I found you guys, and I'm delighted. And are you hearing me?
Yeah, I hear you just fine.
Okay. I'm watching on TV. The mouth doesn't move exactly the same way.
Yeah, no, there's a time delay.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, I worked for IBM for 32 years. And back in 1998-95 timeframe, we knew something was going on with the pension because they kept changing the rules on us.
Mm-hmm.
And when this lady, Ellen Schultz, came out with this book, Retirement Heist, by golly, she's right on target. We knew it was there. I was somewhat of an activist trying to figure this thing out.
Yeah.
And basically, they stole half our pensions.
Yeah.
And they used the retirement funds to boost vapor profit for the compensation for the CEOs and executives, including their supplemental executive retirement plans, top hat programs using the pension. And eventually,
yes,
they converted a cash balance. We had taken, as a class group, two ladies had taken the charge there, and they sued IBM to get that pension back. And they took it all the way to the Supreme Court, who refused to hear it. But they did manage to get $125 million out of the $48 billion that they figured that they lost. So the key thing here is that you ought to read that book, because it not only IBM, but thousands. We lost 100,000 defined benefit pension plans over the last 15, 20 years out of the 150,000 that were originally around. And it was really an assault on the working person, and they did it very, very coyly, very secretly through Watson,
right,
and other groups that advised the corporations, and they knew exactly what they were doing. They became very rich, and I think that's probably what supplemented or boosted the profits during the 90s.
It's amazing.
The Fortune 500.
Mike, I got to run, but thank you. Excellent point. Thank
You're
you.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the very incredibly some long word I can usually not pronounce, ugly, and your calls. Good, the bad, and the very, very erotographomaniacally ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. I should start telling you, here's what that word means. Addicted to writing love letters. We're going to start giving you definitions here. The good, Mitt Romney, our very daily vocabulary lesson. As long as we're not talking economic, Mitt occasionally says the right thing. Speakers at the Value Voters Summit, Romney condemned, rather than pandering to, the hateful rhetoric coming from the American Family Association. Romney said we should remember that decency and civility are values, too. One of the speakers that will follow me today has crossed that line. Poisonous language does not advance our cause. It has never softened a single heart or changed a single mind. Well said. I guess Romney feels a little bit more comfortable moving into the rational middle now that Rick Perry is imploding. The bad. Peter King. Taking a break from his hearing into American Muslim communities, Republican Congressman Peter King went on the Laura Ingraham show to warn the nation about the Occupy Wall Street movement. King called the protests anti-American, which is how he describes pretty much anything he doesn't personally agree with. And then when he went on to say that he was old enough to remember what happened in the 1960s when the left wing took to the streets and somehow the media glorified them and it ended up shaping policy. We can't allow that to happen. I guess King is referring to when the left wing took to the streets to end the Vietnam War and end poverty and end discrimination against blacks. Yeah, I can see why a Republican wants to make sure that doesn't happen again. And the very, very ugly, Rick, don't Google my name, Santorum. In an interview with Fox So-Called News this weekend, Santorum lashed out against those who claim that gay rights is the new civil rights movement of our time. Santorum, who can't get out seven words about condemning homosexuality, said, "You are black by the color of your skin. You are not homosexual by the color of your skin. There are people who were gay and lived a gay lifestyle and aren't anymore. I don't think that's the case with anyone who's black." Right. The old people aren't born gay argument. Sounds like Santorum has been snooping around Michelle Bachmann's husband's gay therapy clinic or closet, your choice. But Santorum is partially right. There are people who are forced to hide the fact that they're gay now because of politicians and zealots like him who would make homosexuality a crime if they had the chance. And that's very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly, in fact. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number, Jack in L.A. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to go back to the writer from the Wall Street Journal. He talks about Reagan and that economy, and he tries to say that, you know, World War II was the big thing that got us out of the Depression. Well, the Cold War was no different. It was the exact same thing. Whether it was a hot war, cold war, it was still government spending. Whether it was done by contracting Northrop, McDonnell Douglas, it was still government money propping up the middle class that we have. I live in Southern California, and I'm 42 years old. That was the dream. Hey, I don't have to go to college. I can just go work at the aerospace company.
Right.
That economy is gone. It was a bubble in and of itself propped up by Reagan's credit card. And I don't know why they can't seem to admit to that.
Well, they want to bring that credit card back. And to a large extent, they still have it, you know, with the wars that we have in Afghanistan, Iraq, and now the drone wars around the world. But the simple question that I asked Stephen Moore at the end of the interview, I think is the most important key to the whole thing. And that is that if the massive government spending that was World War II got us out of the Great Depression, which is the argument that conservatives make, and if the massive government spending that was the Star Wars that tripled our national debt in the 1980s during Reagan and according to them brought down the Soviet Union, and I disagree with that, but we'll just leave it at that. If those kinds of massive military economic stimulus, those kinds of massive government spending programs are what keep our economy going and allowed us to recover from the great crash of 1987, which was the second worst since 1929, you'll recall, then how much greater a society would we be right now if instead of building with that money, instead of using that money to build bombs to drop on Dresden in World War II and Nagasaki, or in 1980s building a Star Wars system that to this day has had $3 trillion spent on it and has yet to demonstrate anything of value, or building bombs that were going to drop, depleted uranium bombs that were going to drop on Iraqis and Afghan people. If instead of doing that, we had taken the exact same massive amount of government money and put it into research and development, put it into building universities, put it into putting all of our kids through college for free, put it into health care for everybody, put it into building schools and hospitals, and building a modern 21st century infrastructure with high-speed rail systems all over the country like Europe has, like Asia has, like China has, Japan has, Korea, South Korea, Taiwan, you name it. If we had simply done that instead of turning to war as our stimulus, how much better off would we be?
And that's a great place, but we can't have that.
Yeah, that's
the rabble above the level of poverty.
And then they come out with the argument that, well, the only time that Americans would tolerate that level of government spending is that it's a time of war, because war brings us all together. And maybe that's true for the right wingers, but I don't think that's true for the majority of Americans. Jack, thank you very much. Excellent, excellent point, and very well said. Doug in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Doug, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? Good show today.
Thank you.
I have in front of me a book by a guy named Garcilaso de la Vega, also known as El Inca. And he was born in 1539. He was the son of an Inca princess and a Spanish conquistador, and was sent back to Spain for education and became a writer, and is generally regarded by scholars of the genre to be the first great writer of the Americas. And in this book, he relates an account by Reverend Father Jose de Acosta, who was a Spanish religious priest, and quite a historian of the conquest and early days of the Spanish in Peru. And in this book, he relates, De La Vega relates this account by the priest about, it says, in 1484, a guy named Alonso Sanchez de Huelva, and he had a small ship, and he did a run where he would go to the Canaries and to Madeira and back to Spain, this small circular route. And at one point, his ship became, in 1484, they were running ahead of a storm for 28 days.
Wow.
And they landed in a place that is now called Santo Domingo, which is now, it became Hispaniola, which is now Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
Right.
And when they landed there, they took in supplies and stuff and turned and came back. Now, they took copious notes, as sailors do.
Right.
And they took notes to come back. And when they got back to Terceira,
right,
Spain, Sanchez de Huelva, and I'm going to read this sentence, they stayed at the house of the famous Genoese Christopher Columbus because they knew he was a great pilot and cosmographer and made seamen's charts.
Right. Doug, can I ask you to get to the point? It's a fascinating story, but there's a lot of other people who'd like to get in.
These guys in to his house after they came back from this voyage, and they were all sick and everything, and befriended them, and they died in his house, leaving him, as A says, heir to the hardships that had caused their death. And among those, of course, were the notes. So the point is, Columbus arranged this voyage and got the financing and did all the things he did to go there because he knew people that had already been there. They had already been there, and they had the logbooks, the charts, the information, how far it was, and how many days it would take to get there, which, of course, was very important for supplies. And so the fact that he discovered anything, that's
I got it. I got it. Well, for that matter, you know, you can go back to the stories of Leif Erikson, you know, 500 years earlier than that.
This particular case, you know, people had already been there. He took these guys in. They died in his house. He kept their logbooks.
Yeah. Fascinating. Doug, thank you for the story. And I remember years ago, Dick Gregory making the comment to me. He says, can you imagine, you know, Christopher Columbus discovered a country that was already occupied? He says, you know, that's like my walking up to a TV store and, you know, see a nice TV in the window and say, hey, I really like that TV. I think I'll go discover it. Yeah. Not such a good idea. Cindy in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Cindy, we have a minute. What's up?
Yeah, well, I'm Italian-American and Scandinavian-American, and I'm not celebrating today, I'll tell you that.
Okay.
I just wanted to say, I want to talk about something else, but I just wanted to comment on the lady who called earlier about boycotting Christmas with all the different companies and so forth.
Yeah.
I think that I really understand where she's coming from and how she feels.
Right.
But I think it would kind of be shooting ourselves in the foot. I think maybe just add street sales for Christmas. I know it might be rough in Cleveland, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, boycott the consumerism of Christmas.
But bring in stuff that you guys might have and want to get rid of and, you know, put a decent price on and just, you know, give a little extra money. Everybody needs it.
Shop at the Salvation Army. Yeah.
Shop at the Salvation Army. Do a little more of that, you know.
Yep.
But I think it would be a bad thing and probably hurt people that maybe you know that work for some of these places. And just making a blanket condemnation of all corporations is kind of...
Well, I think it's more of a condemnation of consumer society.
Consumerism, yeah, I can understand that. I mean, if anybody ever saw that cartoon Christmas Every Day, it was one of the funniest things I ever saw, where everyone just ends up in the poorhouse giving each other rags to the last, you know, because they just got to keep giving gifts.
Yeah.
I mean, just insane in a way.
Yeah, it ultimately doesn't work. Cindy, thank you for the call, and thanks and thanks for listening to us there in Cleveland, Ohio. We'll be right back, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And happy Columbus Day. Happy Genocide Day. Isn't it fascinating? I had nobody call up and defend Christopher Columbus. I was going to tell you about District of Columbia. I'll do that right after this. HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher this coming Friday. Be there, be square. I may be the only lefty guest this Friday. Can I handle that? Yeah, I think so. It should be fun, actually. A guy I really respect and admire. District of Columbia. The District of Columbia, where I live, the District of Columbia was not named after Columbus. It was indirectly named after Columbus. But the founders felt that there should be a place that was, first of all, they noticed that all the you know, the Roman Republic and the Greek democracy, they had goddesses as well as gods. And so America needed a goddess. And so they invented a goddess. And she was on our coins she hasn't been on our coins, I think, for 20 or 30 years. But through most of American history, she was on our coins. Liberty walking, the Liberty quarter, the Liberty half dollar, the Liberty dollar, Liberty gold coins. She is in front of the Justice Department with a blindfold and scales. She's the warrior goddess. She's the goddess of agriculture. She takes all these different forms in all these different ways. But she was the goddess. She is the goddess of this country. She's on the top of the Capitol building. And they wanted there to be an area of the goddess that was so sacred that people who lived and worked there would only do the work of the goddess, would only do the work, the good and righteous work of government. There would be no self-interest allowed. And so they would not be able to vote in Congress. They would voluntarily give up their right to vote in exchange for living in the district of the goddess and being part of the government. This sacred government that was being created. And the goddess's name was Columbus's name, feminized as Columbia. And thus we have the District of Columbia with no vote. So, anyhow, end of that story. Thought it was an interesting one. Amy Goodman, Conversations with Great Minds. We had a conversation Friday night. It's at conversationswithgreatminds.com. Just to give you a heads up, check it out. Jane in Mingo Junction, Ohio. Hey, Jane, what's up?
Tom, the lady who just called, very angry about demeaning Christopher Columbus's mission.
Saying that I was picking on Columbus, yeah.
Exactly. I am looking right now at Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, which you have mentioned before.
Sure.
But specifically, on the very first page, he's speaking about Columbus's personal journal, and Columbus said how friendly these people were when they greeted Columbus's crew,
right,
and how they had no iron, no spears, no weapons of any kind, and he said they would make fine servants.
Yes.
There you have it.
Yeah.
They were to be subjugated.
Yes.
That was the entire purpose.
Well, and really, in a way, that's been the history of culture Jane, thank you for sharing that with us. That's a great one. I had forgotten that, and it's a very, very good one. That's kind of the history of our culture in a long sense. Years ago, I was sitting around a campfire with a group of elders. This was put together by a magazine up in northern New York State, and it was an annual gathering, and there was an elder from Africa, and there was an elder from South America, from two different South American tribes, and there was a Native American elder. His name was Frank. He sat next to me, and I was kind of the white guy elder, and this was maybe 12 years ago, and there was a couple of hundred people there, a lot of young people, and a lot of them were dressed in buckskin, you know, dressed like Indians. And there were a lot of Native Americans there, too, because this was kind of a cross-cultural thing. And I remember Frank leaning over to me and saying, I can't figure out why your young people want to dress like us. He said, why would your white kids want to be like Indians? He said, we have been, I won't use the word, you know, we've been pooped on. We have been stepped on. We have been crushed. We have been the victims of genocide. He said, why? You know, why? And I thought about it for a few minutes, and then it hit me. It just hit me. I said, Frank, you still know the language that your mother's mother's mother spoke all the way back 10,000 years ago. And he said, yes, I do. And he did. He does. He did. He's died since then. And I said, and you know the sacred directions and the sacred ceremonies. And he's like, yeah. And you know the plants that have stories and the animals that have stories and what those stories are and how the world interacts. And he's like, yeah. And I said, you have 10,000 years of continuous memory. Those kids in that audience don't. The African kids in the audience, African-American kids in the audience, there, many of them, their memory is only a couple hundred years back to slavery. And the Caucasian kids, their memory only goes back to basically about 2,000-3,000 years ago, the Roman occupation of Europe, which wiped out all the indigenous people. I went back to Norway and found a stone on my grandfather's, the house that he was born in, that has runic writing on it. Nobody knows what it says. And it was only written 1,500 years ago. And so I said, can you imagine if you didn't know the language of your great-grandparents, if you didn't know the ancient ways, if you didn't know all that? And he said, I can't imagine it. It would be a loss greater than I could bear. And I said, well, that's what all those kids have experienced. Our culture has this giant hole in it. And he said, now I understand why your people are hungry ghosts. And, you know, Columbus was one of those hungry ghosts, in my humble opinion. The invasion of the Celts 3,000 years ago, then the invasion of the Romans 2,000 years ago. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, I'll confront Regent University Law School professor David Velleny, who says adding U.S. citizens to the kill list is just fine. You might be next. Plus, how do we stop the political insanity? I'll talk with Salon.com contributor David Sirota. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there and participate. Show up. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.